You'll have to at least bring the water, Lieutenant, I said above to Lieutenant On. The flower bearer is here, but the water bearer isn't. For a few moments, Lieutenant On said nothing while I finished wiping her face. Right, she said, and went downstairs and filled the bowl and brought it to the flower bearer, where she stood next to me, still frightened, clutching her handful of pink petals. Lieutenant On held the water out to her, and she set the flowers down and washed her hands. But before she could pick the flowers up again, Anandermi and I turned to look at her, and the child started back and grabbed my gloved hand with her bare one. You'll have to wash your hands again, citizen, I whispered, and with a bit more encouragement she did so, and picked up the flowers again and performed her part of the morning's ritual correctly, if nervously. No one else came. I wasn't surprised. The medic, speaking to herself and not to me, though I stood 3 meters away from her, said, Throat cut, obviously, but she was also poisoned. And then, with disgust and contempt, A child of their own house. These people aren't civilized. Our one small attendant left, a gift from the Lord of the Roch clutched in one hand. A pin in the shape of a 4-petaled flower, each petal holding an enameled image of one of the 4 emanations. Anywhere else, a Rodchai who received one would treasure it and wear it nearly constantly, a badge of having served in the temple with the Lord of the Roch herself. This child would probably toss it in a box and forget about it. When she was out of sight, of Lieutenant On and the Lord of the Roch, if not of me, Anandermi and I turned to Lieutenant On and said, Aren't those weeds? A wave of embarrassment overcame Lieutenant On, mixed a moment later with disappointment and an intense anger I'd never seen in her before. Not to the children, my lord. She was unable to keep the edge out of her voice completely. Anandermi and I's expression didn't change. This icon and this set of omens, they're your personal property, I think. Where are the ones that belong to the temple? Begging my lord's pardon, Lieutenant On said, though I knew at this point she meant to do no such thing, and the fact was audible in her tone. I used the funds for their purchase to supplement the term-end gifts for the temple attendants. She had also used her own money for the same purpose, but she didn't say that. I'm sending you back to Justice of Torin, said the Lord of the Roch. Your replacement will be here tomorrow. Shame. A fresh flare of anger and despair. Yes, my lord. There wasn't much to pack. I could be ready to move in less than an hour. I spent the rest of the day delivering gifts to our temple attendants who were all home. School had been cancelled, and hardly anyone came out onto the streets. Lieutenant On doesn't know, I told each one, if the new lieutenant will make different appointments, or if she'll give the year-end gifts, without your having served a whole year. You should come to the house anyway, her first morning. The adults in each house eyed me silently, not inviting me in, and each time I laid the gift. Not the usual pair of gloves, which didn't yet matter much here, but a brightly colored and patterned skirt and a small box of tamarind sweets. Fresh fruit was customary, but there was no time to obtain any. I left each small stack of gifts in the street, on the edge of the house, and no one moved to take them or spoke any word to me. The divine spent an hour or two behind screens in the temple residence and then emerged, looking entirely unrested, and went into the temple where she conferred with the junior priests. The bodies had been cleared away. I had offered to clean the blood, not knowing if my doing so would be permissible, but the priests had declined my assistance. Some of us, said the divine to me, still staring at the area of floor where the dead had lain. "Had forgotten what you are. Now they are reminded." "I don't think you forgot, Divine," I said.
"No."
She was silent for 2 seconds.
"Is the lieutenant going to see me before she leaves?"
"Possibly not, Divine," I said. I was at that moment doing what I could to encourage Lieutenant On to sleep, something she badly needed to do but was finding difficult.
"It's probably better if she doesn't," the head priest said, bitterly.
She looked at me then.
"It's unreasonable of me, I know it is. What else could she have done? It's easy for me to say, and I say it, that she could have chosen otherwise."
"She could have, Divine," I acknowledged.
"What is it you, Radchai, say?"
I wasn't Radchai, but I didn't correct her, and she continued.
"Justice, propriety, and benefit, isn't it? Let every act be just and proper and beneficial."
"Yes, Divine."
"Was that just?"
Her voice trembled for just an instant, and I could hear she was on the edge of tears.
"Was it proper?"
"I don't know, Divine."
"More to the point, who benefited?"
"No one, Divine, so far as I can see."
"No one? Really? Come, One-Esk, don't play the fool with me."
That look of betrayal on Jen Shinnen's face, plainly directed at Anander Mee and I, had been obvious to everyone there. Still, I couldn't see what the Lord of the Roch had stood to gain from those deaths.
"They would have killed you, Divine," I said.
"You and anyone else they found undefended. Lieutenant On did what she could to prevent bloodshed last night. It wasn't her fault she failed."
"It was."
Her back was still to me.
"God forgive her for it. God forbid that I may ever be faced with such a choice."
She made an invocatory gesture.
"And you? What would you have done if the lieutenant had refused, and the Lord of the Roch ordered you to shoot her?" "Could you have? I thought that armor of yours was impenetrable."
"The Lord of the Roch can force our armor down. But the code Anander Mee and I would have had to transmit to force down Lieutenant On's armor, or mine, or any other Radchai soldiers, would have to have been delivered over communications that had been blocked at the time. Still, speculating about such things does no good, Divine," I said. "It didn't happen." The head priest turned and looked intently at me.
"You didn't answer the question."
It wasn't an easy question for me to answer. I had been in pieces, and at the time only one segment had even known that such a thing was possible, that for an instant Lieutenant On's life had hung, uncertain, on the outcome of that moment. I wasn't entirely sure that segment wouldn't have turned its gun on Anander Mee and I instead.
"It probably wouldn't have."
"Divine, I'm not a person. If I had shot the Lord of the Roch, nothing would have changed, I was sure, except that not only would Lieutenant On still be dead, I would be destroyed. 2-Esk would take my place, or a new 1-Esk would be built with segments from Justice of Torin's holds. The ship's AI might find itself in some difficulty, though more likely my action would be blamed on my being cut off. People often think they would have made the noblest choice, but when they find themselves actually in such a situation, they discover matters aren't quite so simple.
As I said, God forbid. I will comfort myself with the delusion that you would have shot the Mee and I bastard first.
Divine, I cautioned. She could say nothing in my hearing that might not eventually reach the ears of the Lord of the Roch.
Let her hear. Tell her yourself.
She instigated what happened last night. Whether the target was us, or the Tanmind, or Lieutenant On, I don't know.
I have my suspicions, which, I'm not a fool.
Divine, I said. Whoever instigated last night's events, I don't think things happened the way they wished. I think they wanted open warfare between the upper and lower cities, though I don't understand why. And I think that was prevented when Denzai told Lieutenant On about the guns.
I think as you do, said the head priest. And I think Jen Shinnen knew more, and that was why she died.
I'm sorry your temple was desecrated, Divine, I said. I wasn't particularly sorry Jen Shinnen was dead, but I didn't say so. The Divine turned away from me again.
I'm sure you have a lot to do getting ready to leave. Lieutenant On needn't trouble herself calling on me. You can give her my farewells yourself.
She walked away from me, not waiting for any acknowledgement. Lieutenant Skyot arrived for supper with a bottle of arak and 2 Sevenissas.
Your relief won't even reach cooled Vess until midday, she said, breaking the seal on the bottle.
Meanwhile, the Sevenissas stood stiff and uncomfortable on the ground floor. They had arrived just before I'd restored communications. They'd seen the dead in the Temple of Ikt and guessed without being told what had happened. And they had only been out of the holds for the last 2 years. They hadn't seen the annexation itself. All of Ors, upper and lower, was similarly quiet, similarly tense. When people left their houses, they avoided looking at me or speaking to me. Mostly, they only went out to visit the temple, where the priests led prayers for the dead. A few Tanmind even came down from the upper city and stood quietly at the edges of the small crowd. I kept myself in the shadows, not wanting to distract or distress any further.
Tell me you didn't almost refuse, said Lieutenant Skyot, in the house on the upper floor, with Lieutenant On behind screens.
They sat on fungal-smelling cushions, facing each other.
I know you, On. I swear when I heard what Sevenissa saw when they got to the temple, I was afraid I'd hear next that you were dead. Tell me you didn't.
I didn't, said Lieutenant On, miserable and guilty, her voice bitter. You can see I didn't.
I can't see that, not at all.
Lieutenant Skyot poured a hefty slug of liquor into the cup I held out, and I handed it to Lieutenant On.
Neither can one ask, or it wouldn't be so silent this evening.
She looked at the nearest segment.
Did the Lord of the Roch forbid you to sing?
No, Lieutenant. I hadn't wanted to disturb Anander Mianai when she was here, or interrupt what sleep Lieutenant On could get. And anyway, I hadn't much felt like it. Lieutenant Skyot made a frustrated sound and turned back to Lieutenant On.
If you'd refused, nothing would have changed except you'd be dead too. You did what you had to do, and the idiots... Hers, cock, those idiots! They should have known better.
Lieutenant On stared at the cup in her hand, not moving.
I know you, On. If you're going to do something that crazy, save it for when it'll make a difference.
Like Mercy of Sarsa 1, Amat 1? She was talking about the events at Ime, about the soldier who had refused her order, led that mutiny 5 years before.
She made a difference, at least. Listen, On, you and I both know something was going on. You and I both know that what happened last night doesn't make sense unless...
She stopped. Lieutenant On set her cup of arak down, hard. Liquor sloshed over the lip of the cup. Unless what? How does it make sense?
Here. Lieutenant Skyot picked up the cup and pressed it into Lieutenant On's hand. Drink this and I'll explain. At least as much as makes sense to me. You know how annexations work. I mean, yes, they work by sheer undeniable force, but after. After the executions and the transportations, and once all the last bits of idiots who think they can fight back are cleaned up, once all that's done, we fit whoever's left into Radshai society. They form up into houses and take clientage, and in a generation or two, they're as Radshai as anybody. And mostly that happens because we go to the top of the local hierarchy. There pretty much always is one, and offer them all sorts of benefits in exchange for behaving like citizens. Offer them clientage contracts, which allows them to offer contracts to whoever is below them. And before you know it, the whole local setup is tied into Radshai society with minimal disruption. Lieutenant On made an impatient gesture. She already knew this.
What does that have to do with...
You fucked that up.
I...
What you did worked, and the local Tanmind were going to have to swallow that. Fair enough. If I'd done what you did, gone straight to the Orzean priest, set up house in the lower city instead of using the police station and jail already built in the upper city, set about making alliances with lower city authorities and ignoring...
I didn't ignore anyone,
Lieutenant On protested. Lieutenant Skyot waved her protest away. And ignoring what anyone else would have seen as a natural local hierarchy... Your house can't afford to offer clientage to anyone here, yet. Neither you nor I can make any contracts with anyone. For now. We had to exempt ourselves from our house's contracts and take clientage directly from Anander Mianai while we serve. But we still have those family connections, and those families can use connections we make now, even if we can't. And we can certainly use them when we retire. Getting your feet on the ground during an annexation is the one sure way to increase your house's financial and social standing. Which is fine until the wrong person does it. We tell ourselves that everything is the way Amat wants it to be, that everything that is because of God. So if we're wealthy and respected, that's how things should be. The aptitudes prove that it's all just, that everyone gets what they deserve, and when the right people test into the right careers, that just goes to show how right it all is.
I'm not the right people,
Lieutenant On set down her empty cup, and Lieutenant Skyot refilled it. You're only one of thousands, but you're a noticeable one to someone. And this annexation is different. It's the last one. Last chance to grab property, to make connections on the sort of scale the upper houses have always been accustomed to. They don't like to see any of those last chances go to houses like yours. And to make it worse, you're subverting the local hierarchy.
I used the local hierarchy.
Lieutenants, I cautioned. Lieutenant On's outburst had been loud enough to be heard in the street, if anyone had been on the street this evening. If the Tanmind were running things here, that was as things must be in Amat's mind, right?
But they...
Lieutenant On stopped. I wasn't sure what she had been about to say. Perhaps that they had imposed their authority over Orz relatively recently. Perhaps that they were, in Orz, a numerical minority, and Lieutenant On's goal had been to reach the largest number of people she could. Careful, warned Lieutenant Skyot, though Lieutenant On hadn't needed the warning. Any Radshai soldier knew not to speak without thinking. If you hadn't found those weapons, someone would have had an excuse not only to toss you out of Orz, but to come down hard on the Orzeans and favor the upper city. Restoring the universe to its proper order. And then, of course, anyone inclined could have used the incident as an example of how soft we've gotten. If we'd stuck to so-called impartial aptitudes testing, if we'd executed more people, if we still made ancillaries...
I have ancillaries, Lieutenant On pointed out.
Lieutenant Skyot shrugged. Everything else would have fit. They could ignore that. They'll ignore anything that doesn't get them what they want. And what they want is anything they can grab.
She seemed so calm, even almost relaxed.
I was used to not seeing data for Lieutenant Skyot. But this disjunction between her demeanor and the seriousness of the situation, Lieutenant On's still extreme distress, and, to be honest, my own discomfort at events, made her seem oddly flat and unreal to me.
I understand Jen Shinnen's part in this, Lieutenant On said. I do, I get that. But I don't understand how anyone else would benefit.
The question she couldn't ask directly was, of course, why Anander Mianai would be involved, or why she would want to return to some previous, proper order, given she herself had certainly approved any changes. And why, if she wanted such a thing, she didn't merely order the thing she desired. If questioned, both lieutenants could, and likely would, say they weren't speaking of the Lord of the Roch, but about some unknown person who must be involved. But I was certain that wouldn't hold up under an interrogation with drugs. Fortunately, such an event was unlikely. And I don't see why anyone with that sort of access couldn't just order me gone and put someone they preferred in my place, if that was all they wanted.
Maybe that wasn't all they wanted, answered Lieutenant Skyot. But clearly, someone did at the very least want those things and thought they would benefit from doing it this particular way. And you did as much as you could to avoid people getting killed. Anything else wouldn't have made any difference.
She emptied her own cup.
You're going to stay in touch with me, she said, not a question, not a request. And then more gently, I'll miss you.
For a moment I thought Lieutenant On might cry again. Who's replacing me?
Lieutenant Skyot named an officer and a ship.
Human troops, then.
Lieutenant On was momentarily disquieted and then sighed, frustrated. I imagine she was remembering that Orr's was no longer her problem.
I know, said Lieutenant Skyot. I'll talk to her. You watch yourself. Now annexations are a thing of the past. Ancillary troop carriers are crowded with the useless daughters of prestigious houses who can't be assigned to anything lower.
Lieutenant On frowned, clearly wanting to argue, thinking maybe of her fellow Esk lieutenants, or of herself. Lieutenant Skyot saw her expression and smiled ruefully. Well, Dariot is all right. It's the rest I'm warning you to look out for. Very high opinions of themselves and very little to justify it.
Skyot had met some of them during the annexation, had always been entirely, correctly polite to them.
You don't need to tell me that, said Lieutenant On.
Lieutenant Skyot poured more arak, and for the rest of the night, their conversation was the sort that needs no reporting.
At length, Lieutenant On slept again, and by the time she woke, I had hired boats to take us to the mouth of the river, near Kul Dves, and loaded them with our scant luggage and my dead segment. In Kul Dves, the mechanism that controlled its armor and a few other bits of tech would be removed for another use.
If you're going to do something that crazy, save it for when it'll make a difference, Lieutenant Skyot had said. And I had agreed. I still agree. The problem is, knowing when what you are about to do will make a difference. I'm not only speaking of the small actions that, cumulatively, over time, or in great numbers, steer the course of events in ways too chaotic or subtle to trace. The single word
that directs a person's fate, and ultimately the fates of those she comes in contact with, is of course a common subject of entertainments and moralizing stories. But if everyone were to consider all the possible consequences of all one's possible choices, no one would move a millimeter or even dare to breathe for fear of the ultimate results. I mean, on a larger and more obvious scale. In the way that Anandar Mianai herself determined the fates of whole peoples, or the way my own actions could mean life or death for thousands, or merely 83, huddled in the temple of Ikt, surrounded. I ask myself, as surely Lieutenant On asked herself, what would have been the consequences of refusing the order to fire? Straightforwardly, obviously, her own death would have been an immediate consequence. And then, immediately afterward, those 83 people would have died, because I would have shot them at Anandar Mianai's direct order. No difference, except Lieutenant On would be dead. The omens had been cast, and their trajectories were straightforward, calculable, direct, and clear. But neither Lieutenant On nor the Lord of the Roch knew that in that moment, had one disc shifted just slightly, the whole pattern might have landed differently. Sometimes, when omens are cast, one flies or rolls off where you didn't expect and throws the whole pattern out of shape. Had Lieutenant On chosen differently, that one segment, cut off, disoriented, and yes, horrified at the thought of shooting Lieutenant On, might have turned its gun on me and I instead. What then? Ultimately, such an action would only have delayed Lieutenant On's death and ensured my own, One Esk's destruction. Which, since I didn't exist as any sort of individual, wasn't distressing to me. But the death of those 83 people would have been delayed. Lieutenant Skyot would have been forced to arrest Lieutenant On. I'm convinced she wouldn't have shot her, though she would have been legally justified in doing so. But she wouldn't have shot the Tan Mind, because me and I wouldn't have been there to give the order. And Jen Shinnen would have had time and opportunity to say whatever it was that the Lord of the Roch had, as things actually happened, prevented her from saying. What difference would that have made? Perhaps a great deal of difference. Perhaps none at all. There are too many unknowns, too many apparently predictable people who are, in reality, balanced on a knife edge, or whose trajectories might be easily changed. If only I knew. If you're going to do something that crazy, save it for when it'll make a difference. But, absent near omniscience, there's no way to know when that is. You can only make your best approximate calculation. You can only make your throw and try to puzzle out the results afterward. Chapter 11. The explanation why I needed the gun, why I wanted to kill Anandar Mianai, took a long time. The answer wasn't a simple one, or more accurately, the simple answer would only raise further questions for Striegen. So I didn't attempt to use it, but instead began the whole story at the beginning and let her infer the simple answer from the longer, complex one. By the time I was done, the night was far advanced. Saevarden was asleep, breathing slow, and Striegen herself was clearly exhausted. For 3 minutes there was no sound but Saevarden's breath accelerating as she transitioned into some state closer to wakefulness, or perhaps was troubled by a dream. "And now I know who you are," Striegen said finally, tiredly. "Or who you think you are." There was no need for me to say anything in reply to that,
By now she would believe what she wished about me, despite what I had told her.
Doesn't it bother you? Striegen continued. Didn't it ever bother you that you're slaves?
Who?
The ships. The warships. So powerful, armed. The officers inside are at your mercy every moment. What stops you from killing them all and declaring yourselves free? I've never been able to understand how the Radchai can keep the ships enslaved.
If you think about it, I said, you'll see you already know the answer to your question.
She was silent again, inward-looking.
I sat motionless, waiting on the results of my throw.
You were at Garsed, she said after a while.
Yes.
Did you know Saevarden? Personally, I mean?
Yes.
Did you participate?
In the destruction of the Garsedai? She gestured acknowledgement. I did. Everyone who was there did. She grimaced, with disgust, I thought.
No one refused.
I didn't say that. In fact, my own captain had refused and died. Her replacement had qualms. She couldn't have hidden that from her ship, but said nothing and did as she was told. It's easy to say that if you were there, you would have refused, that you would rather die than participate in the slaughter. But it all looks very different when it's real, when the moment comes to choose. Her eyes narrowed in disagreement, I thought, but I had only spoken the truth. Then her expression changed. She was thinking, perhaps, of that small collection of artifacts in her rooms on Dras Anya station.
You speak the language?
Two of them. There had been more than a dozen.
And you know their songs, of course.
Her voice was slightly mocking. I didn't have a chance to learn as many as I would have liked.
And if you had been free to choose, would you have refused?
The question is pointless. The choice wasn't presented to me.
I beg to differ, she said, quietly angry at my answer. The choice has always been presented to you.
Garsed was a turning point. It wasn't a direct answer to her accusation, but I couldn't think of what would be a direct answer that she would understand. The first time so many Radchai officers came away from an annexation without the certainty that they had done the right thing. Do you still think me and I controls the Radchai through brainwashing or threats of execution? Those are there, they exist, yes. But most Radchai, like people most places I've been, do what they're supposed to because they believe it's the right thing to do. No one likes killing people. Striegen made a sardonic noise.
No one?
Not many, I amended. Not enough to fill the Roch's warships. But at the end, after all the blood and grief, all those benighted souls who without us would have suffered in darkness are happy citizens. They'll agree if you ask. It was a fortunate day when Anander Mianai brought civilization to them.
Would their parents agree? Or their grandparents?
I gestured, halfway between not my problem and not relevant. You were surprised to see me deal gently with a child. It shouldn't have surprised you. Do you think the Radchai don't have children, or don't love their children? Do you think they don't react to children the way nearly any human does?
So virtuous.
Virtue is not a solitary, uncomplicated thing. Good necessitates evil, and the two sides of that disc aren't always clearly marked. Virtues may be made to serve whatever end profits you. Still, they exist and will influence your actions, your choices.
Striegen snorted. You make me nostalgic for the drunken philosophical conversations of my youth. But these aren't abstract things we're talking about here. This is life and death.
My chances of getting what I had come for were slipping from my grasp. For the first time, Roch forces dealt death on an unimaginable scale without renewal afterward. Cut off irrevocably any chance of good coming from what they had done. This affected everyone there.
Even the ships?
Everyone. I waited for the next question, or the sardonic, "I don't feel sorry for you," but she just sat silent, looking at me. The first attempts at diplomatic contact with the Presger began shortly afterward, as did, I'm fairly certain, the beginnings of the move to replace ancillaries with human soldiers. Only fairly certain because much of the groundwork must have been laid in private, behind the scenes.
"Why would the Presger get involved with the Garsid?" Stregan asked.
She could certainly see my reaction to her question, nearly a direct admission that she had the gun. Had to know, had to have known before she spoke, what that admission would tell me. She wouldn't have asked that question if she hadn't seen the gun, examined it closely. Those guns had come from the Presger. The Garcedi had dealt with the aliens, whoever had made the first overture. So much we got from the captured representatives. But I kept my face still. Who knows why the Presger do anything? But Anander Mianai asked herself the same question. Why did the Presger interfere? It wasn't because they wanted anything the Garcedi had. They could have reached out and taken whatever they wanted. Though I knew the Presger had made the Garcedi pay, and heavily. And what if the Presger decided to destroy the Roch? Truly to destroy it? And the Presger had such weapons.
"You're saying," said Stregan, disbelieving, appalled, "that the Presger set the Garcedi up in order to compel Anander Mianai to negotiate?"
I am speaking of Mianai's reaction, Mianai's motives. I don't know or understand the Presger. But I imagine if the Presger meant to compel anything, it would be unmistakable, unsubtle. I think it was meant merely as a suggestion, if indeed that had anything to do with their actions.
All of that, a suggestion.
They're aliens. Who can understand them?
"Nothing you can do," she said after 5 seconds of silence, "can possibly make any difference."
That's probably true.
Probably.
If everyone who had... I searched for the right words. If everyone who objected to the destruction of the Garcedi had refused, what would have happened?
Stregan frowned. "How many refused?"
4.
4? Out of?
Out of thousands. Each justice alone in those days had hundreds of officers along with its captain. And dozens of us had been there. Add the smaller crude mercies and swords. Loyalty, the long habit of obedience, a desire for revenge, even, yes, those 4 deaths kept anyone else from such a drastic choice.
There were enough of your sort to deal with even everyone refusing.
I said nothing. Waited for the change of expression that would tell me she had thought twice about what she had just said. When it came, I said, "I think it might have turned out differently."
"You're not one of thousands," Stregan leaned forward, unexpectedly vehement.
Savardin started out of her sleep, looked at Stregan, alarmed and bleary.
"There are no others on the edge of choosing," Stregan said. "No one to follow your lead,
And even if there were, you by yourself wouldn't be enough. If you even get as far as facing me and I, facing one of me and I's bodies, you'll be alone and helpless. You'll die without achieving anything. She made a breathy, impatient sound. Take your money. She gestured toward my pack, leaning against the bench I sat on. Buy land, buy rooms on a station, hell, buy a station. Live the life that was denied you. Don't sacrifice yourself for nothing.
Which me are you talking to? I asked. Which life that was denied me do you intend I live? Should I send you monthly reports so you can be sure my choices meet with your approval? That silenced her for a full 20 seconds. Breck, said Save Arden, as though testing the sound of the name in her mouth. I want to leave. Soon, I answered. Be patient. To my utter surprise, she didn't object, but leaned back against a bench and put her arms around her knees. Striegen looked speculatively at her for a moment, then turned to me.
I need to think.
I gestured acknowledgement, and she rose and went into her room and shut the door.
What's her problem? Asked Save Arden, apparently innocent of irony.
Voice just slightly contemptuous. I didn't answer, only looked at her, not changing my expression. The blankets had marked a line across her cheek, fading now, and her clothes, the Nilter trousers, and quilted shirt under the unfastened inner coat, were wrinkled and disheveled. In the past several days of regular food and no kef, her skin had regained a slightly healthier-looking color, but she still looked thin and tired.
Why are you bothering with her? She asked me, undisturbed by my scrutiny,
as though something had shifted and she and I were suddenly comrades, fellows. Surely not equals, not ever. Business I need to attend to. More explanation would be useless, or foolish, or both. Are you having trouble sleeping? Something subtle in her expression communicated withdrawal, closure. I wasn't on her side anymore. She sat silent for 10 seconds, and I thought she wouldn't speak to me any more that night, but instead she drew a long breath and let it out.
Yeah, I need to move around. I'm going to go outside.
Something had definitely changed, but I didn't know quite what it was or what had caused it. It's night, I said, and very cold. Take your outer coat and gloves and don't go too far. She gestured acquiescence, and even more astonishingly, put on her outer coat and gloves before going out the two doors, without a single bitter word or even a resentful glance. And what did I care? She would wander off and freeze, or she wouldn't. I arranged my own blankets and lay down to sleep, without waiting to see if Save Arden came back safe or not. When I woke, Save Arden was asleep on her own pile of blankets. She hadn't thrown her coat on the floor, but instead hung it beside the others on a hook near the door. I rose and went to the cupboard to find she had also replenished the food stores. More bread and a bowl on the table holding a block of slushy, slowly melting milk. Another beside it holding a chunk of bove fat. Behind me, Striegen's door clicked open. I turned.
He wants something, she said to me quietly.
Save Arden didn't stir.
Or anyway, there's some angle he's playing. I wouldn't trust him if I were you.
I don't. I dropped a hunk of bread in a bowl of water and set it aside to soften. But I do wonder what's come over her. Striegen looked amused. Him, I amended.
Probably the thought of all the money you're carrying, observed Striegen.
You could buy a lot of kef with that.
If that's the case, it's not a problem. It's all for paying you. Except my fare back up the ribbon, and a bit more for emergencies, which in this case would probably mean Savardin's fare as well.
What happens to addicts in the Roch?
There aren't any.
She raised one eyebrow and then another, disbelieving.
Not on the stations, I amended. You can't get too far down that road with the station AI watching you all the time. On a planet, that's different. It's too big for that. Even then, once you get to the point where you're not functioning, you're re-educated and usually sent away somewhere else.
So as not to embarrass.
For a new start. New surroundings, new assignment. And if you arrived from somewhere very far away to take some job nearly anyone could have filled, everyone knew why that was, though no one would be so gauche as to say it within your hearing. It bothers you that the Rodchai don't have the freedom to destroy their lives or other citizens' lives.
I wouldn't have put it that way.
No, of course not. She leaned against the doorframe, folded her arms.
For someone who wants a favor, an incredibly, unspeakably huge and dangerous favor at that, you're unexpectedly adversarial.
One-handed, I gestured, it is as it is.
But then, dealing with him makes you angry.
She tilted her head in Savardin's general direction.
Understandably, I think.
The words, "I'm so glad you approve," rose to my lips, but I didn't say them. I wanted, after all, an incredibly, unspeakably huge and dangerous favor. All the money in the box, I said instead. Enough for you to buy land, or rooms on a station, or hell, even a station.
A very small one.
Her lips quirked in amusement. And you wouldn't have it anymore. It's dangerous even to have seen it, but it's worse to actually have it.
And you,
she pointed out, straightening, dropping her arms, voice now unamused,
will bring it directly to the attention of the Lord of the Roch, who will then be able to trace it back to me.
That will always be a danger, I agreed. I wouldn't even pretend that once I fell into Mianai's control, she wouldn't be able to extract any information from me she wished, no matter what I wanted to reveal or conceal. But it has been a danger since the moment you laid eyes on it, and will continue to be for as long as you live, whether you give it to me or not.
Stregan sighed. That's true. Unfortunately enough, and truth to tell, I want very badly to go home.
Foolish beyond belief, but it wasn't my concern. My concern was getting that gun.
I said nothing.
Neither did Stregan. Instead, she put on her outer coat and gloves and went out the two doors, and I sat down to eat my breakfast, trying very hard not to guess where she had gone, or whether I had any reason at all to be hopeful. She returned 15 minutes later with a wide, flat black box. Stregan set the box on the table. It seemed like one solid block, but she lifted off a thick layer of black, revealing more black beneath. Stregan stood, waiting, the lid in her hands, watching me. I reached out and touched a spot on the black, with one finger, gently. Brown spread from where I touched, pooling out into the shape of a gun, now exactly the color of my skin. I lifted my finger, and black flooded back. Reached out, lifted off another layer of black, beneath which it finally began to look like a box, with actual things in it, if a disturbingly light-suckingly black box filled with ammunition.
Striegan reached out and touched the upper surface of the layer of black I still held. Gray spread from her fingers into a thick strap, curled alongside where the gun lay.
I wasn't sure what that was. Do you know?
It's armor. Officers and human troops used externally worn armor units, instead of the sort that was installed in one's body, like mine. But 1,000 years ago, everyone's had been implanted.
It's never tripped a single alarm, never shown up in any scan I've been through.
That was what I wanted. The ability to walk onto any Rajshahi station without alerting anyone to the fact I was armed. The ability to carry a weapon into the very presence of Anander Mianai without anyone realizing it. Most Ananders had no need for armor. Being able to shoot through it was just an extra. Striegan asked,
How does it do that? How does it hide itself?
I don't know. I replaced the layer I was holding and then the very top.
How many of the bastard do you think you can kill?
I looked up, away from the box, from the gun, the unlikely goal of nearly 20 years' efforts in front of me, real and solid, in my grasp. I wanted to say, as many as I can reach before they take me down. But realistically, I could only expect to meet one, a single body out of thousands. Then again, realistically, I could never have expected to find this gun.
That depends, I said. If you're going to make a desperate, hopeless act of defiance, you should make it a good one.
I gestured my agreement. I plan to ask for an audience.
Will you get one?
Probably. Any citizen can ask for one and will almost certainly receive it. I wouldn't be going as a citizen.
Striegan scoffed. How are you going to pass as non-Rajshahi?
I will walk onto the docks of a provincial palace with no gloves or the wrong ones, announce my foreign origin, and speak with an accent. Nothing more will be required. She blinked, frowned.
Not really.
I assure you, as a non-citizen, my chances of obtaining an audience will depend on my reasons for asking. I hadn't thought that part all the way through yet. It would depend on what I found when I got there. Some things can't be planned too far in advance.
And what are you going to do about?
She waved an ungloved hand toward unconscious Savardhan. I had avoided asking myself that question. Avoided from the moment I found her, thinking more than one step ahead when it came to what I was going to do about Savardhan.
Watch him, she said. He might have reached the point where he's ready to give up the Kef for good, but I don't think he has.
Why not?
He hasn't asked me for help.
It was my turn to raise a skeptical eyebrow. If he asked, would you help?
I'd do what I could, though of course he'd need to address the problems that led him to use in the first place, if it was going to work long term. Which I don't see any sign of him doing.
Privately, I agreed, but I didn't say anything.
He could have asked for help any time, Striegan continued. He's been wandering around for, what, at least 5 years? Any doctor could have helped him if he wanted it. But that would mean admitting he had a problem, wouldn't it? And I don't see that happening any time soon.
It would be best if he went back to the Rach. Rach medics could solve all her problems, and wouldn't trouble themselves with whether or not Savardhan had asked for their help, or wanted it in any way.
He won't go back to the Rach unless he admits he has a problem.
I gestured, not my concern.
He can go where he likes.
But you're feeding him, and no doubt you'll pay his fare up the ribbon and to whatever system you take ship for next. He'll stay with you as long as it's to his advantage, as long as there's food and shelter. And he'll steal anything he thinks will get him another hit of Kef.
Savarden wasn't as strong as she had once been, or as clear mentally. Do you think he'll find that easy?
No, admitted Stregan. But he'll be very determined.
Yes. Stregan shook her head as though to clear it.
What am I doing? You won't listen to me.
I'm listening. But she clearly didn't believe me.
It's none of my concern, I know. Just...
She pointed to the black box.
Just kill as many of me and I as you can. And don't send him after me.
You're leaving? Of course she was. There was no need to answer such a foolish question, and she didn't bother. Instead, she went back into her room, saying nothing else, and closed the door. I opened my pack, took out the money and set it on the table, slid the black box into its place, touched it in the pattern that would make it disappear. Nothing but folded shirts, a few packets of dried food. Then I went over to where Savarden lay and prodded her with one booted foot. Wake up. She started, sitting suddenly, and flung her back against the nearby bench, breathing hard. Wake up, I said again. We're leaving. Chapter 12. Except for those hours when communications had been cut off, I had never really lost the sense of being part of Justice of Torin. My kilometers of white-walled corridor, my captain, the decade commanders, each decade's lieutenants, each one's smallest gesture, each breath, was visible to me. I had never lost the knowledge of my ancillaries, 20-bodied, one Amat, one Torin, one Atrepa, one Bo, and two Esk. Hands and feet for serving those officers, voices to speak to them. My thousands of ancillaries in frozen suspension. Never lost the view of Shiserna itself, all blue and white, old boundaries and divisions erased by distance. From that perspective, events in Ors were nothing, invisible, completely insignificant. In the approaching shuttle, I felt the distance decrease, felt more forcefully the sensation of being the ship. One Esk became even more what it had always been, one small part of myself. My attention was no longer commanded by things apart from the rest of the ship. Two Esk had taken One Esk's place while One Esk was on the planet. Two Esk prepared tea in the Esk decade room for its lieutenants. My lieutenants. It scrubbed the white-walled corridor outside Esk's baths, mended uniforms torn on leave. Two of my lieutenants sat over a game board in the decade room, placing counters around, swift and quiet, three others watching. The lieutenants of the Amat, Torin, Atrepa, and Bo decades, the decade commanders, Hundred Captain Rubrin, administrative officers and medics, talked, slept, bathed, according to their schedules and inclinations. Each decade held 20 lieutenants and its decade commander. But Esk was now my lowest occupied deck. Below Esk, from Var down, half of my decade decks was cold and empty, though the holds were still full. The emptiness and silence of those spaces where officers had once lived had disturbed me at first, but I was used to it by now. On the shuttle, in front of One Esk, Lieutenant Awn sat silent,
jaw clenched. She was, in some respects, more physically comfortable than she had ever been in Oars. The temperature, 20 degrees C,